right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again for a very special episode of Dom and Colin. Dom, how are you feeling tonight?
I'm feeling good. I'm excited to be doing this because the first time we did this episode 10 years ago, it wasn't welcome back, it was welcome. This was the first episode that we ever did. And I don't think we envisaged then quite how long we would be doing this for, and may still continue to do this in the future. Who knows? What better way to mark our 10-year anniversary, not with any kind of original idea, but by just doing exactly the same thing we did for that very first episode hundreds of episodes ago and 10 years ago at this point.
Yeah, back on as November 11th was becoming November 12th, recorded very late at night, as has continued to be the case for most of our episodes over the ensuing decade, we sat down for the very first time to talk about the latest Survivor episode at that point, which was the thrilling South Pacific Merge episode. And today, 10 years later, we are back to do it again. And before, just quickly, we dive into all of that, I did want to reference something that I thought was very funny, just to make sure that I was not wrong about what date we began. I did go back and look it up, because I felt it was very within mine and our range to release this anniversary episode inadvertently, like, on the wrong day. I thought that was a very realistic possibility, so I went to the very beginning of our blog archive to make sure that I had the date right, and thought that the post was something that aged pretty hilariously, so I wanted to just quickly read to you guys from the very first thing we ever published. We said about our first episode, "We hope you can forgive some of the interruptions and dead spots, as this was our first time using the recording software, as well as literally the first time we've ever spoken to each other in person. This episode of the maybe soon to be named podcast can be downloaded here, and we hope to be able to stream it on the homepage soon, as apparently it's really easy to put a podcast on iTunes, so hopefully we can make that happen as well." And end quote, and mission accomplished on eventually getting it up on iTunes and coming up with a name. Honestly, mission not accomplished on coming up for a name. We literally just put in the Dom and Colin podcast as a placeholder and never got around to changing it, and it just kind of became the name. But the funniest
in the stored list of links that I had from years ago, where just it had a bunch of stuff, including the link to the homepage, because it stored whatever the, I guess, the cached version was at the time that I bookmarked it, it still just says the Dom and Colin podcast, brackets, name pending. And I feel like that's the perfect state for it to remain in for evermore.
Yes. On this blog post, we actually got a comment from someone who was listening in real time to the very first episode. So while we did manage to eventually get it up on iTunes and develop something of a following there, I did love that the only comment that we got on episode one in the moment was, "Hope Colin won't interrupt Dom so much in the future, as it's just the two of you, and it's not like either would be shortchanged for time." And mission very much not accomplished on that front, but hopefully we can do better today.
Incredibly cutting and accurate, and remains both of those to this day. So still working on that. We're always in the market for self-improvement. Hopefully, when we do this again in 10 years' time, we'll all have made some strides towards fixing that.
Are we committing, if this is still a thing in 10 years, are we redoing the Survivor South Pacific Merge again?
If the internet is still around in 10 years, if the apocalypse has not befallen us, sure, why okay. not? Let's make this a regular thing.
Booked. All right. Dom... Yes, let's get into it, though, because this Survivor South Pacific Merge, the very first episode we ever covered, an episode that essentially inspired us to begin this podcast in the first place because there was so much interesting stuff going on to be talking about. Having just recently rewatched this for the first time in many, many years, I don't actually even know the last time that I rewatched South Pacific, but before we dive into the specifics... South specifics? All right, awful start. Did want to say, just as a general note, before we get like sidetracked on all of the strategic stuff and the Cochrane of it all and everything, this episode still absolutely slaps. This is some great Survivor.
So good.
Yeah.
It is phenomenal. Yeah. And in a season which I think I don't know how the reception has actually changed in the 10 years since compared to where it was at the time. But in a season which I don't think is generally regarded all that well, this is a phenomenal episode of Survivor, and I think has aged so wonderfully. And even the things about it and about the season, which going into it when, you know, we didn't know each other then and we weren't obviously discussing it on the podcast at the time. But when we heard the theme of the season is Redemption Island is coming back again. And guess what? The returnees this time are Coach and Ozzie. And just all of these individual aspects of it that built up preseason and then over the first few episodes, they somehow all come together in such a perfect storm in this episode to just make it a honestly thrilling hour of TV, even despite, you know, we will have and continue to have for as long as we breathe criticisms of the idea of Redemption Island. But the whole Aussie Redemption Island story arc is so perfectly set up and concluded in this episode that to me, it's almost worth taking those 5 minutes out of every other episode in the season just to set all of that up. So, whatever other things you might say about the season as a whole, this one episode in isolation and in context, just absolutely stunning, even after all this time.
Glad we can start off on a high note of Dom strongly advocating for the return of Redemption Island, really delivering on the Edgelord of Extinction status you have earned over the last 10 years or so here, Dominic. But yeah, what we are going to be doing here today...
Can you imagine if you had floated the idea of Edge of Extinction back in the heyday of Redemption Island in the early 2010s.
Would it have been particularly crazy compared to Redemption Island? I feel like it's basically, well, there are obviously plenty of differences, not too far removed. It's just Redemption Island minus people being eliminated each week.
I guess more so if you had had the teaser of in however many years' time, season 40, we'll have Redemption Island and, Edge of Extinction and Boston Rob. Fill in the blanks from there and then just try and reverse engineer what would have to happen.
Yes. I mean, many, many things I think would be jarring beyond words if we had had a crystal ball into what the next 10 years of Survivor and just the next 10 years of humanity would have looked like over that.
And,
yeah.
And even just the cast of characters that you see at play in this episode, South Pacific, it contains multitudes where, on the one hand, as we flagged up in our main Survivor 41 coverage last week, South Pacific, I think, holds the dubious honor of having the most people, by some margin, in that list of most purple, most invisible contestants of all time, more so than really any other season. You've got Keith and Whitney, the gruesome twosome. You have Rick. You have Elise, who was so invisible that you actually forgot she was on the list when we were setting all of that up. And then even some others. You know, Edna is not jumping out of the screen at you. And there are a lot of people who don't really play a part in the story this season. And this is a very story-driven season, more so than any other. And if you as a player don't have a part to play in that story, then you just get sidelined and no one remembers you. On the other hand, this is an incredibly top-heavy cast as well. Like, you have Cochran, who would come back and win a season. Sophie, the winner of the season, who would go on to play again in Winners of War and become this bedrock of the, you know, Survivor analysis kind of community and discourse in the years in between. You have Coach completing this three-season legacy. You have Ozzie apparently playing again, but it's not like Game Changers actually changed the game or his legacy in any way, regardless, so we can ignore that. So this is a cast of heroes and zeros, basically, not to take anything away from any of them or add more to any of them than they're due.
Well, I think you're also... I don't think Dom, if I may speak on your behalf, as I am often fond of doing, I don't think you were saying that anyone you did not just list is a zero by comparison either. But the point certainly overall taken and valid there as far as I'm concerned. But yeah.
This cast, across the years, so at a point where we had the least reach that we have ever had, probably, still to this day, I think this is the cast with the most interviewees that we've had of any season. And this was the perfect season to start with, not just in terms of how it actually worked out back then with people being willing to talk and people being good guests, but just getting those people on. Like, we had Cochran, Coach, Sophie, Albert, and Jim. Like, that's a pretty decent portion of that merch tribe, just giving us each of their individual perspectives, and then we can kind of synthesize those and come to a pretty good picture of what the season was like. And because at the time, at least for that short window, we were the only ones really doing that in that particular way, I feel like we can take some amount of credit for just the understanding of that season that emerged at the time. Now, of course, since then, all of those people have, you know, given many further interviews, and Rob, I'm sure, has done several rewatches and like watch along podcast series of South Pacific across the years, whether it's the Top 40 Countdown, Evolution of Strategy, whatever. But at the time, when all of that was in a much more nascent state, it felt really good to be able to do our part to put ourselves on the map, but in the course of helping to put the season into the public in a new light as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think as far as like our listenership goes, we had a drastically smaller reach back then than we do today. But as far as being able to have access to the survivors themselves, I'm very confident that we just peaked in 2011, 2012, yes, and has just been gradually declining ever since then. But yeah, a very fun episode to be returning to here. And one more time before we dive into the specifics and the strategic nuances, etc., wanted to just generally say about South Pacific and this point of South Pacific, and I'm honestly hazy on if this would have necessarily been our rough kind of perspective at the time, but certainly over the last 10 years, Survivor as a game has evolved dramatically. And a lot of the stuff that we focus on in our regular podcasts these days are about whatever the new twists and advantages are of the week and what the most kind of fluid spots within the game look like. I feel like South Pacific, and maybe this would not be the case if we were doing a full season rewatch, and the merge is obviously going to be a high point of most seasons, and I think it's especially true of a season like this, but at least in the year 2021, it's actually kind of refreshing to go back and examine a fascinating strategic spot where the political dynamics, frankly, couldn't be more clear. Like, this is totally unlike anything that we've talked about over the last 10 years, and I think that's almost becoming a novelty, is having these two very clear kind of sides on either half of the beach.
Yeah, this is not a fluid season of Survivor, right? There are no live tribals here. There's nothing of any of that. And that helps to make the stakes so clear and so stark. And even going back to the pre-merge here, where you know these tribes are mostly going to sit together at the merge, barring one crucial person flipping back and forth, That last pre-merge tribal challenge, that felt so consequential. Like, that, it really did feel like this is going to be a $1 million challenge for one of these people, because whoever ends up in the outside after that merge vote is going to have a real tough time scrabbling their way back up, unless they're Aussie and they get to go on this just Herculean immunity run, Redemption Island run, whatever it is. And even he falls just tragically short at the very end, and yet another just fantastic storyline that continues throughout the season. So in one sense, both in terms of time where the season occurred in the franchise, is coming off of this big reset that happened with Heroes versus Villains, and then the show is struggling to find its footing again, and it is experimenting with some more of these game-breaking twists. And we are in, and South Pacific is included in this for many people, this is the dark era or the dark ages of Survivor, right? That stretch of, depending on your criteria, like Nicaragua through Caramoan, maybe, with this one bright spot in Philippines. For some people, South Pacific is not a bright spot. It is the continuation of that trend, which made them really question their love of the show. For us, this is something which took our engagement with the show to a whole new level. But on top of that, it has this quality to it where it's straddling that divide between new school and old school, where you have two returning players, and that choice of returning players doesn't even have any like obvious logic to it. It's just Coach and Aussie, just two complete randoms in that sense. And you have Redemption Island and so on. On the other hand, no swap, right? A pagonging once we get down to a certain point. And it has this quite old school vibe in terms of like the religious undertones, or I guess explicit overtones at times, to Upolu versus the quite different vibe of Savai. And you got the sense these were two just very different units of people. It's not just, well, this is the green team and this is the blue team. It's, this is Savai, this is Upolu. They are very different in terms of who they are in real life, how they play the game, and how one feeds into the other. And you will see that showdown really be amped up to the extreme over the course of this 13-episode story arc.
Yeah, and while there are certainly some, if not quite a few, newer school elements to South Pacific as a whole, this, in my mind, from a modern perspective, having seen the next decade of Survivor play out, is a conclusively kind of old school iteration of a Survivor season, even acknowledging that plenty of other seasons that came right before or right after it were not necessarily in that same mold, just because of the way this all played out, specifically the two very clear sides, and then one of them takes majority, and it's a pegonging from there, is kind of a trademark old school Survivor storyline. But yeah, let's get into it here. We have a ton to be getting into. And as you referenced, this, I think, is a pretty important place to kind of start, even before we get to the merge itself, is how we got here, the importance of that final pre-merge immunity challenge. And gun to my head, and I don't know why, these are the two that stand out to me all this time later, but South Pacific and, for some random reason, Exile Island, season 12, really jumped to mind when I think of the most, or the highest stakes, I guess, final pre-merge immunity challenges, where, like, if that one challenge just goes the other way, and in both cases, I believe, they were very, very close to going the other way, the entire rest of that season almost surely looks completely different. And so in this case, what that means is Savai ends up, I think, narrowly losing that episode 6 or episode 7, whatever it is, final pre-merge immunity challenge. And the way that we are going to be entering this kind of merge situation, and it's going to play a big role in how this dynamic ends up playing out, is, for anyone who may have forgotten this, Ozzy, anticipating that the merge is right around the corner and he's going to be a huge favorite to win whatever the duel ends up being and come back into the game right away, sends himself to Redemption Island and essentially gives Cochran kind of like a stay of execution, which I think plays a major role in the way that the rest of this is going to play out. And honestly, as generally uncomplimentary as I would say we have been about Redemption Island just as a twist over the years, and probably were even in real time the first time around, as you said earlier, this one storyline about Ozzy going there on purpose and having it work out, and he gets to be the big hero and give Cochran himself the idol for safekeeping while he's off being the team champion on Redemption Island. As much as I frankly loathe the fact that Redemption Island, the twist, was ever concocted and implemented in the first place, this is a storyline that I have to imagine was like way beyond anything they ever could have anticipated. They, meaning the producers, as far as how good Redemption Island could possibly be. Because while the duel, I wouldn't say is necessarily the most thrilling TV, and I kind of hate that it ended up taking whatever it was, 5-6 minutes of episode time out of this incredible episode and merge that we, I'm guessing, could have had plenty more content from had they not had to spend so much of it on Redemption Island. It really does play well. And if you want to be more generous than I have tended to be about Redemption Island just as a twist and the way that it was executed upon, this Ozzy sending himself there and having it all work out, I think, is way beyond anything the showrunners or I ever could have dreamt up, and is genuinely very good stuff.
If Redemption Island is going to work as a concept, it's going to be when you cast two of the biggest martyr savior complexes of all time on your season as returning players. You can't draw it up better than that. And if that doesn't lead to any good outcomes from Redemption Island, then maybe the entire concept is doomed to fail.
Yes, but so Ozzy is going to have that all work out. He's going to win the duel. He's going to beat Christine, who, by the way, I'm not going to go so far as to call it like a robbery that Christine wasn't on second chance or whatever. And she's certainly someone that I would be totally down to somehow see back on Survivor in the future, as obviously unlikely as that probably is at this point. She is one of the people that I would be thinking of when I say the list that Dom gave of all the big characters earlier on in this podcast. By no means, I think, suggests that everyone who was not on that list is a zero. I feel like Christine in particular could have been a much bigger presence than she was on this season or on many other seasons, and which isn't to say she obviously played a very big role during the pre-merge portion of South Pacific here, but I feel like South Pacific in general is a cast where, even though plenty of them are highlighted extensively, there are many, many more that kind of are forgotten in the year 2021 that, and part of that is pretty understandable, you know, not just because of how much time has passed, but how at certain times imbalanced the edit was on this season. I feel like there are a bunch of people, pre-mergers and post-mergers alike, who under different circumstances could have brought way more to a random season of Survivor.
Yeah, and Christine, I think, firstly, what brutal luck that after surviving there so long, the final boss that she has to beat to get back in the game is Ozzy, of all people, not just on the cast, but in the entire history of Survivor. If you had to, you know, select a random opponent to have to beat in that final duel, Ozzy is, you know, top five toughest of all time, at the very least, probably. Whereas if it is, Cochran gets voted out. I have to think Christine has to like her chances against Cochran. And if she wins that, comes back into the game, I think that is one of those butterfly effect moments, right? Where maybe the legacy of Cochran never carries through to Caramone in quite the same way. This season itself looks very different. And then also, I would have to think Christine, as the first female returnee from Redemption Island, and you're one of the first in general, given that this was the second season, I imagine she would have been in the mix for some kind of return appearance on another season herself by that point.
Yeah, I would at least hope that she was a name being tossed around in the production room or whatever there. One other thing before we close the book, temporarily at least, on Redemption Island for this season. I'm guessing anyone hearing us right now who has seen South Pacific and has a even kind of passing memory of how all of this played out is very aware that the way this episode segment began is with Ozzy entering the arena and really giving the hard sell to Upolu on this fake story about how he got idled out by Cochran the night before, and he's devastated, and there's never going to be any salvaging of that relationship. And I certainly went into this episode saying, okay, here we go. Ozzy's going to do a bad job acting here. And I have to say, Dom, my memory did no justice to just how bad this was. I want to roll the tape here on Ozzy's performance for anyone who hasn't seen this season in a while, because I know you're sitting there saying, okay, yeah, I remember Ozzy did not do a very good job. You really need to hear this over again. So let's roll this clip of Ozzy trying to sell this facade to Upolu.
Welcome to Redemption Island Arena. Both tribes are here to witness today's duel. Ozzy, are you surprised to find yourself on Redemption Island?
I mean, I gave pretty much everything to my tribe, and then we lose one challenge because somebody can't operate a clip, and that ends up being the person that sends me here. You play the idol, you don't even... I know someone else probably knew that you had it. As far as I'm concerned, tribe boundaries, I mean, if we're at the merge, they don't exist anymore. It's all one for one, and whoever sticks together from this point on makes it farthest in the game. But I thrive on the pressure to come back in the game for revenge, basically.
Really strong stuff here from Ozzy. And this, by the way, is a classic illustration of something that I've been talking about in recent weeks on the main Survivor podcast, as we are currently covering Survivor 41. This is a perfect illustration of the weak means strong, strong means weak kind of principle in Survivor and in games in general. This was about as over the top as you can possibly draw it up here, but one way or another, Ozzy is going to get the job done there, and right away we can see that the people watching this duel on the Upolu side are not buying it. And I would imagine that when they get to their merge beach and Coach draws the line in the sand and lays out for Cochran, as we'll get to later, what he thinks is actually going on, and then later on at Tribal Council, Sophie and Albert are like very overt about, we didn't believe this for a minute and we were frankly kind of insulted that you thought this would work. I think Ozzy is probably largely to blame for that, just given how aggressive he was with the hamming it up here on Redemption Island.
Yeah, and Ozzy is back for revenge, basically, which is such a perfect quote. And how I still to this day flummox as to how that was not the episode title instead of Double Agent or whatever.
Yes.
Very generic thing it was instead.
Absolutely, that would have been a strong call there. But Ozzy,
I think it is a good sign, by the way, of how hilariously doomed this plan was always going to be, that Ozzy takes a lot of pride in hoodwinking Christine as to the circumstances of his apparent vote out, which I'm not sure why you care about her believing this, because either you win and she's gone and has no further impact on the game whatsoever, or she comes back in, your whole plan has been scuppered, and now I don't know what she's meant to do with that information other than, you know, figure it out for herself. But this is one of those things which, you know, we came to this from a poker background, that like that's how we met initially, and then that was the circle of people that we were initially discussing the show with. And so you can blame us, I think, for introducing the term results oriented into the Survivor lexicon. And we really beat that term into the ground back in the day. I have come around to this being one of those decisions where I am happy being completely results oriented about it. Like, if Ozzy loses this challenge, I get that maybe there's a small chance of that happening, but you fucked up if you send yourself there with this harebrained scheme which you can't even sell convincingly, and then you lose and have to go out the Redemption Island arena with your tail between your legs. You have failed. I don't care how likely the plan was to work in the abstract, that is a personal failure on your part.
Yes, I was actually wondering to myself somewhat recently, I don't know how many total podcasts we have done at this point, but over the course of 10 years, probably getting pretty close to 800, 900, 1,000, somewhere around that range. I really wonder how many different times we have used the terms both results oriented and equity, because I would imagine it's well over one per episode each. It is a staggeringly high number that is frankly embarrassing.
It does not bear thinking about. And yeah. I also, so the episode prior to this, before we were podcasting, but we were still, you know, chatting about it, the thing that was most confusing about this was, why is it so imperative that Ozzy has to beat Christine? Because surely after being voted out in the way that she was, and with Stacey's monologue on Redemption Island and her putting the middle finger up to Coach and so on, it would surely seem like if Christine won her way back in, she is going straight to the Survivors and joining them. And so either way, this is going to be a number added on to the Survivor vote count. And the one thing that could scupper it is if Cochran ends up flipping. And so that previous episode, surely the much safer thing to do is you vote out Cochran, right? You hope that he loses to Christine, which even though he was later to become a certified challenge piece at the time, pretty sure he would have lost to Christine. And then it seems like that would have, if anything, like cemented their hold on the game. It turns out that Christine said she actually probably would have just gone back to the Upolu anyway for some reason. And so this actually was like a kind of necessary thing for Ozzy to do here to bolster their vote count. So at least you got to respect the hustle in locking that down. But every single part of the execution beyond, I guess, winning the challenge itself was so hilariously bad that it really made the episode.
Yeah. So I definitely remember as we were covering this the first time and as we said very, at least I said very awkwardly, like to Cochran's face repeatedly when we interviewed him shortly after this season ended. Both of us had a very hard time coming to terms with the decision that Cochran is ultimately going to make at the end of this episode. And I'm sure along the way here, we probably will flag up many counterpoints about why flipping may not have like not just not the right idea, but like a very, very bad idea. However, Dominic, 10 years removed from this experience, this time around, I feel like in rewatching this episode, I found myself much more sympathetic to Cochran's side of things here, and a lot of the points that he made when we talked to him rang much more true to me than they did in the moment. And I don't know if that's me just growing older and wiser. I'm sure if that's even happening in the first place. Certainly growing older, not so sure about the wisdom there, but or just not having seen this season in plenty of time and having it kind of jog my memory just watching this one episode. But this time around, I do think it would be worth flagging up some of the things that we were very quick to dismiss back in 2011, 2012, when we were talking through this in more detail here. And in particular, thinking about it less in terms of like the sheer math, which again, as you said, like we were talking about Survivor at this point in time, almost exclusively with people in kind of the poker world, and more from the perspective of an actual human being going through this experience themselves. And I think to actually kind of flash back a little bit before we even get to Redemption Island, one scene that I had forgotten at least the specifics of that kind of set that ball into motion for me into being more sympathetic for Cochran this time around is the night after they vote, or I guess the night that they vote out Ozzy. Once they get back to camp after having done so, they are still of the mindset that like, okay, Ozzy is now off on Redemption Island. He's hopefully going to come back in after winning that duel, and we are about to merge. And right away, and again, as always, very happy to grant that this is a heavily edited TV show and they're setting us up for why Cochran is going to make the decision that he does. But one thing I had just forgotten about that I think does have to play a role if you are in the Cochran spot, and I'm guessing that there was much, much more of this, not just this evening, but many other evenings on that Savaii beach that added up over time, is even though all of the people on this tribe were aware of what Ozzy was about to do and were at least implicitly, if not explicitly, okay with him making that decision for himself, they returned to their camp and legitimately seemed like unhappy with Cochran that he allowed Ozzy to do that, right? Even though it was completely Ozzy's idea, and Keith is saying, I don't know, man. That's just not how I live my life. I don't want other people fighting my battles for me. And Cochran seems understandably pretty dejected about that. And then Cochran's trying to be like proactive about this whole thing. And he's saying, okay, well, one way or another, Ozzy is off on Redemption now. And when we hopefully get to the merge beach tomorrow, presumably when I go to the other tribe, they're going to ask me, what kind of bonds exist between the rest of you? And what do you guys think I should tell them? Like, what's our plan here going forward so that we can best execute on this mission that we've now put ourselves into, and they don't seem to have like any sort of insight for him. They literally say, I don't care. You can say whatever you want.
It is so tinted, because even if you and Cochran, maybe you don't have much in common, you don't like him, he doesn't like you, whatever, you know, this kid is, he may be the reason the word superfan came into existence, right? Like, he was not the first necessarily, but like the first of that exaggerated archetype in quite that way. And so if you want to relate to him, if you want to keep him on board, what is going to be $1 million vote for one person in this game, then the easiest way to do that, the cheat code to getting Cochran to remain on board, is to strategize with him, right? It's to talk about the game and think about the game and speculate, map out these possibilities. And he gets to be in on the joke here. Like, he gets to make the big move and be the double agent. And, oh, hey, you can tell them this about me. And, oh, what if, get a load of this. What if we said this about such and such? That is such an easy way to, like, just create a bond out of whole cloth with him. And they just aren't, they don't even go through the motions of pretending to be interested. It's so, like, obviously that was going to be a lost cause with Keith. Keith is just not wired that way, never going to be on board. Same thing with Whitney, I think. Dawn gives Cochran the time of day, genuinely is nice to him, tries to open that connection. He seems to trust her and vice versa. But also, she's not going to be playing the game on that wavelength with him, at least not on this season. Maybe more to come on that front. And so it is going to kind of fall too. I guess Ozzy is off on redemption now, so maybe the gyms of the world, right? Like, someone has to do that with him. Otherwise, this whole plan is completely ill-conceived, and just no one is. No one is willing to do that.
And not only that, Jim was the very first interview we ever did on this podcast. I am a big Jim fan in general, but I think there are many holes that can be poked in some of the lines that Jim took pre-merge with making Cochran feel good. And we certainly heard Cochran get into that in plenty of detail when we talked to him about, like, Jim was eager to talk to me and strategize with me. And I personally, Colin, believe that Jim did feel like Cochran was someone that he could work with in the long term. And if Savai took the numbers, honestly, probably would have been down with to, like, roll through with the end, potentially even over, like, Ozzy and Keith and Whitney. Like, I think Ozzy is someone it's very difficult to let make to allow to go too deep into any season, and Keith and Whitney are such an obvious duo. I buy that from Jim's perspective, he was very open to working with Cochran very long term. And at the same time, though, the entire pre-merge, pretty much, Cochran is constantly the decoy boot every time Savai'i goes to Tribal Council, and particularly at the Papa Bear Tribal Council, where they vote him out and they are at least slightly nervous and want to guard against the super off chance that Papa Bear miraculously has an idol to save himself with. Jim putting his own vote on Cochran to protect against Papa Bear potentially putting his vote on Jim, I think had steep ramifications on how good Cochran was ever going to feel.
I wonder when the last time I thought about Papa Bear was. Like, just as a, like, I registered that he existed as a surviving contestant. It's got to be literal years at this point. So that's a real deep cut there, blast from the past. But
point being here, I'm making an effort this time around to look at things beyond the numbers that we will eventually get to once the necklaces and idols are taken into consideration and so forth, and am much more, I guess, kind of like in tune with the Cochran perspective here. I believe, at least, in rewatching this for the first time in a long time, I found myself much more sympathetic towards that school of thought. As we will hear Cochran bring up repeatedly over the course of this episode, he spent like the entire pre-merge never feeling liked or respected by the vast majority of people on his tribe. And now what they're asking him to do is stick his hand in a bag of rocks on their behalf and just let fate take full control over his game, when what he does is not numbers and odds. What he loves is the game Survivor. Like, I am far more open to that kind of school of thought this time than I feel like I was 10 years ago.
Yeah, we will definitely get deep in the weeds on that as we get towards that vote, and won't shock anyone, I think, especially the longtime listeners, that I also am much more sympathetic towards his side of things now. Also worth noting that the whole event that sets in motion this Aussie martyrdom act is they lose that challenge in the episode before, and Cochrane gets blamed for losing them that challenge. And I think it has already degenerated to the point where Cochrane would have been blamed for losing any challenge, regardless of what the facts of the matter actually were. But this is one thing that has stood out to me, or stood with me after all of these years. And usually you are much better at recalling, if not the details of seasons, at least the details of our interviews than I am. Like, you are able to conjure up these anecdotes that the people gave, and that has proved very useful, and I'm also very jealous of it. But one thing that even I can remember is Cochrane was so mad that it was actually Jim who, like, fumbled the buckling of the clip or whatever, in a way that basically left Cochrane with no agency in that challenge, and it was always gonna end in disaster. And so the fact that he got blamed for that was especially galling, given how everything was later gonna play out and how he ended up being the scapegoat for so much. And you know, I think that helps to illuminate part of what's going on here.
It certainly felt like, and I don't think he's probably wrong at all for feeling like this was the case. Like, as far as most of the people on his tribe were concerned, he could pretty much do no right during the pre-merge and was really just getting by on them not feeling like it was quite time to get rid of him yet, because some other thing had randomly come up. But they were very clear about the fact that if we had to get rid of you, that would not break any of our hearts.
Mm-hmm. And so Cochrane has been given his assignment here, and he is in two minds about it, but you know, he still has Ozzy's idol in his pocket from the tribal council before, which is a thing we should get to in due course. And he summarizes this opening statement here with this quote, which didn't really stand out at the time in 2011, but in 2021, it has a whole new meaning to it. Let's take a listen.
That's a good one.
You know, right now, my philosophy, to kind of take from Al Pacino, first you get the egomaniac returning player voted out. Then you get his idol. Then you get the $1 million.
So several egomaniac returning players voted out across Cochrane's later Survivor work, and maybe $1 million to boot in there as well.
Yes, and another Cochrane quote that I thought was characteristically well put by him, and also left me with some questions about, like, what the plan would have been if the kind of ruse that they were attempting to pull here on the Upolus didn't get pretty much instantly blown up. Is he gives another confessional where he says, you know, if anyone can become a double agent, it's me. I've already been pretending that I like the people on my tribe for the last 18 days. But between that kind of suggesting to me that he is actively trying to go with this double agent plan based on what he knows at that point before having actually interacted with the Upolus, and then the beginning of his conversation with Coach, where he seems to, at least in the very early part of it, trying to be like laying the groundwork for genuinely being that kind of double agent, I really do wonder if the Upolus had either somehow not picked up on the fact that this was a ruse, or if they had just played dumb and let him do whatever he was attempting to do and then use that information to make their plan going forward. Do you think that Cochrane genuinely would have kept attempting this double agent line had it seemed like it was going well?
I think so. Yeah, I think there's a real chance of that. But part of the inherent danger in this double agent plan is if you are someone who you feel like you're on a sure footing with your tribe, then I think it's much safer to essentially cut yourself off from your tribe and go through the pretense of them not liking you, being distant from you, and trying to integrate yourself into the other team. Whereas for someone in Cochrane's position, it is basically, all right, you already feel totally rejected by us. We now are casting you away at the very moment where we need to repair that relationship the most. And also, we are, in air quotes, pretending to dislike you, even though we very much do actually dislike you. And that comes through. And Cochrane, whatever his social foibles, is very aware of that. And, you know, every aspect of this double agent plan is a reminder that the reason this is so convincing is because you genuinely are on the outside of this group and they don't respect you. And now you're sending him over to this group who is going to welcome him with open arms and butter him up and treat him like he is this prince and he's so funny and delightful and so on. And how can he not warm to them more instead of you after all of that, even if, you know, absent this plan, you know, the two tribes merge and maybe Cochrane gets to know them and starts liking them more and so on. But you are really doing your best to push him away from you and towards them as much as humanly possible.
Right, yes. So we do indeed finally merge here now, Dom. And I believe it is the case that Cochrane was genuinely, at least at the beginning, going to attempt to go through with this double agent ruse here. But right away, as soon as they're on the same beach, or at least in the TV presentation, it seems very quickly, it seems very quick that they arrive at the beach together. We get our merged tribe name of, I'll give the listeners a moment to try to come up with what the merged tribe name was for South Pacific, because this is certainly one that when I'm like quizzing myself on what the merged tribe names have been over the years, I am constantly forgetting about. How about the Tetuna tribe, Dom, which apparently is based on, according to Keith, something to do with the story of how the coconut came to be. Maybe someday we'll get some better known merge tribe name backstory on all of that. But truly one of the most forgettable merge tribe names of all time for my money. And Cochrane goes to work on Coach, or at least attempts to go to work on Coach. But in fact, I would say it is pretty much Coach going to work on Cochrane here with, as far as I can tell, Cochrane tries to start him down the path of, I'm ready to be a loyal Upolo person after all of the craziness from our last tribal council where I idled out Ozzy and sent him to Redemption Island. Coach really puts a quick stop to that, and let's roll the clip on this, because I believe this may ultimately prove to be the defining conversation of this season. So here is Coach and the line in the sand.
So how are you feeling after last night?
I'm hoping it'll get better. Today has been like a rebirth. I seriously feel like today I woke up,
right,
felt like this is, you know.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, this is where the real game begins right now.
Somehow, as luck would have it, our plan worked perfectly. Ozzy demolished Christine in the duel. There was a merge. We're back 6-6. Now it's time for me to work my magic like I knew I could all along, become the double agent I was born to be, infiltrate Upolu, and change the game.
I don't want to sound like I'm bad enough, my tribe, just the way they treated me was, I thought, horrible. Like Keith, the way Keith talks to me, constantly ostracizing me for my performance and challenge. This last challenge was erupted. I mean, they hated me before that,
sure,
but that
sure
was...
Okay. So tell me what you're thinking strategically.
Strategically, I'm wondering if I'm working with the right people right now.
Here's the thing. I'm going to tell you right now, our tribe has a budget.
and I feel like you guys are trying to play us. Okay? You guys came up with a story. You guys sent Ozzy to redemption. You got an idol in your pocket.
Okay.
And knowing that Ozzy would win redemption, it was a risk, but you knew that Ozzy would win redemption.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
We will not bend. We will vote six strong. And if all six of us vote together, there's a 1 in 5 chance that you're going to be drawing a black rock. And so will I. And that's a way to play the game.
Yeah.
Whether or not, I'm going to tell you, whether or not these people have really treated you like that.
Yeah.
Just saying, right? Yeah. Whether or not they have or not. Let's say that they've treated you like gold. Okay?
Yeah.
I know. You just what I'm saying. I know what those kind of people think about people with intellect. I've been made fun of my whole life, dude. Okay? I might be the Dragon Slayer now, but I know what it feels like to be superior in one way to people, and they know it. So they find ways that you're inferior to cut you down. I know what that feels like, man. But you have a chance to change the game for yourself. There's a line in the sand. Come across that line.
And even having rolled the clip here and giving as full of a context as we possibly can here, I really do think it is worth mentioning that, as far as I can tell, and maybe I'm just reading into this because I know the results of how this is all going to play out, but I swear, you can see the look on Cochran's face when Coach kind of cuts him off and says, okay, you took a big risk, but you sent Ozzy to Redemption Island on purpose, and it was a gamble, but you knew that he would win on Redemption, okay? And Cochran says, okay. He just kind of nods, and in that moment, his face, like, drops, and it seems like he recognizes right away, this is not going to work. They are clearly they are clearly aware of what we are trying to pull here. So did want to mention that. Even hearing the audio, I feel like, does not do justice to just what a soul read this was.
It is so good. Yeah. And for me, the kicker is, you got an idol in your pocket. And I don't know if that is, you as a tribe, as a collective, or you, Cochran, have Ozzy's idol in your pocket right now, but maybe the ambiguity there really helped. But that's when it really becomes clear that, like, okay, we have just been completely soul-read. The entire plan has been sussed out, and there's no point in me keeping up this double agent artifice anymore because, I mean, hey, I already feel rejected by my own tribe. I don't want to insult the intelligence and be blatantly lying to the faces of the one other tribe who maybe now can take me in and offer a different way forward.
Right, and Sophie will go on to say at Tribal Council that she literally found it insulting that they tried to pull this over on them with the whole Ozzy sending himself to Redemption Island gambit there. And I think it was a smart move on Cochran's part once he is clearly aware that this plan is going to go absolutely nowhere. It seems like it doesn't take him too long to meet up with Coach, along with Sophie and Albert, and basically come clean and put his cards on the table and say, all right, I'm spilling the beans. This is the actual scoop here. And I think that is the dead right idea in the Cochran spot here, is to stop insulting their intelligence and accept the reality of the situation.
Yeah, I think it's a crucial skill to know when, you know, the jig is up and you've come up with a scheme, you've tried to do it and it's failed, and you now have the choice of, do you dig yourself even deeper into this ditch, or do you back away and put your hands up and say, all right, yeah, look, this is what I was trying to do, I'm sorry, but can we move forward now, you know, on a more honest footing? And Cochran, to his credit, you know, I think especially Cochran knows that he is not the ideal kind of actor to be a double agent. So even though he has had to pretend to like his tribe for the past 18 days and so on, he does not have the kind of fluency that he would need to just mosey up to this new group and blend in effortlessly. And in fact, the fact that he can't do that is why he has been nominated for that role in the first place. So I think he knows that he does not have the acting talent in him to pull this off, even in the face of obvious opposition. So he drops the whole facade and he comes clean to this group, like in this forest clearing of Sophie, Coach, and Albert, who are going to end up being this kind of power nexus of the Upolu group. And this is around the point where supposedly he gets offered a final four deal by that group. And that goes some way to putting some context for why he would think he might have some inroads within Upolu once it gets down to just the seven of them or the six of them plus one. And also is where a lot of people are minded to give Sophie credit, supposedly as the one who, according to Cochrane, did a lot of work to make him feel like, okay, you have people on your side within Upolu, you know, as we start getting the numbers down. But just watching the episode and taking it at face value, we already thought in real time that Coach was really putting on a clinic this season. And this was, it seemed to be like, this is the crowning moment, right? This is the moment where once Coach gets his $1 million check on finale night, you look back and this is the thing in the montage where this is where he really nailed it down.
Right. And this is honestly, Dom, something that even 10 years later, I still really struggle with, is if I were just a random juror who was on this South Pacific season, I still don't know if at the end of the day, I would find myself voting for Sophie or voting for Coach. And I'm saying that with the assumption that it was pretty clear to everyone on the jury that Albert was not going to be a name in consideration there. And it was basically deciding between one of those two, because like on one hand, it seems to me like well, eager to grant that I'm sure Sophie was doing quite a bit to make Cochrane feel good. It really is because of Coach and his kind of leading the team and constantly reiterating the honor, loyalty, integrity thing that it seems like, while super annoying and hypocritical in general, is pretty much exactly what Brandon and Rick and Edna needed to hear over and over again to stay solid, or like the best line you could take to make sure that those specific people never turn on you and probably aren't going to group up against you in the end game. And by Sophie's own admission, it is Coach who they said, okay, you be the person who goes and talks to Cochrane and does whatever you can, do whatever you can to get him on our side. And like on from that perspective, I certainly feel like, while not at all trying to suggest that Sophie and others did not play very meaningful roles in getting Cochrane's vote ultimately on their side, I have a hard time feeling like anyone other than Coach deserves the most credit for that. And I feel like this is just the game-winning move right here, is getting Cochrane to vote with them at this merge vote. But at the same time, I also have a hard time deducting points from Sophie when her entire game is based around, I know Coach is going to put himself out there in this leadership position, and people at the end of the game are not going to respond well to what at that time will become clear as a lot of bullshit and hypocrisy and so forth. And even knowing that he's going to be in a position to receive the lion's share of the credit, if people are willing to give credit, I'm confident he's not going to turn on me. And I'm confident that at the final tribal council, people will vote for me over him. And that, to this day, Dominic, is a circle I have been unable to square.
And it's what makes the end game of the season, even though it is a very strict begonging, and we have some interesting twists and turns along the way. I would say Brandon Hans giving up the necklace is one of the most just under-discussed moments in the entire run of Survivor. But as we play down towards that endgame, even though it seems incredibly predictable, it's, you have this inner core of three, and we're just lopping off the outer layers of the onion until we get down to that final three. Despite all of that, it still was captivating at the time and is fun to look back on in retrospect, because I don't think Albert was really in with the chance of winning by that point. But with Coach and Sophie, it felt like that final tribal was very live in the sense of every other season which gets told as a story of why someone lost. By the time we get to the final tribal, they have lost. It is game over. So Stephanie, for example, you know, was drawing dead well in advance of that final two clobbering by Danny. Or Russell had lost Samara well in advance of, you know, Natalie White and Eric's speech of final tribal, so on and so forth. This one felt like maybe the most live final tribal that we've seen, in the sense of if Coach does own his bullshit, he probably wins the season. And so you are taking a, in one sense, a massive risk, but maybe it's actually placing a smart, calculated bet that Coach will not do that. That is so alien to who he is. He cannot say, you know, he cannot drop that facade of honor and loyalty and integrity and so on. If he did, he wins $1 million. But he didn't, so he lost it. And it happened right there in the moment on day 39. And that's what makes that whole culmination of the season so electric for me.
One thing that I've certainly heard Sophie say multiple times is she feels pretty strongly that if this tribal council, the final tribal council, had taken place in the era where Jeff is like very heavy-handedly leading the discussion, she believes that Coach would have won because Jeff would have just led him down the path of here's what you need to say.
Yeah, and I recall something about the closing statements where it's like, oh, very convenient that these would be here on a season where, all right, Coach, maybe we should try that again. Maybe if you want to sum up your game in a new way, this would be the time to do so. It was interesting that they were added there, is the observation. But
yes.
Yeah, but if we end up revisiting the season in more detail, that whole endgame dynamic obviously is something that we'll get pretty deep in the weeds on. For now, though, where do we want to circle back to the events in motion here?
Well, I did want to say big time credit to Coach and Sophie and Albert in that conversation where Cochran comes clean to them in the forest clearing, where they, for my money, do a good job kind of laughing it off that, okay, thank you for finally being honest with us. We had a very strong suspicion the entire time, but it's all good. We're not going to hold anything against you for doing what you thought you needed to do in the moment. And we are very eager, man, to bring you in on the team and would love to work with you going forward. I feel like the disparity between the treatment that he had gotten from Savai to that point and finally getting this breath of fresh air, especially at what I would have to imagine is one of the highest points of tension for him of this entire experience thus far, where he goes in and an hour or two before this thinks he's about to be the double agent and has that spot completely blown up. And I would imagine is just kind of, blowing in the wind. What do people do in the twisting in the wind is what I'm trying to say. Where I think, were they less forgiving? Were they less cool and forgiving about it? He may have gotten a different vibe, or felt like he was being pandered to or whatever. But I think they really went above and beyond at making him feel welcome as a group, as part of the group, with Upolo and with specifically them. And like, he had some sort of outs to make it deep into the end game if he did indeed want to hop on board with them. And we hear Cochran literally say, Upolu is a solid group who are being honest with me. And up until this point in the game, I've been playing with a group that I don't trust and who don't respect me. And again, it is something that I have a hard time overlooking in terms of if you do flip with Upolu, you are completely opening the door for that now 6-5 majority to just completely freeze you out and freeze out all of Savai. And that is obviously what we are going to go on to see end up happening here. But I really do find myself being a lot more understanding this time around of like just how vulnerable Cochran probably was in this spot and how much of a breath of fresh air it must have been to finally feel like, for the first time, potentially in the entire 18 or however many days you've been out there, you feel like you actually have room to play and people who want to play with you.
I do think it might actually go a long way here that Sophie is actually confesses to have been on the season quite like antisocial and sarcastic and so on, where it's like, oh, at least I'm being teased in a playful-ish way as opposed to just having Keith endlessly heap shit upon me in a very sincere way. Like, I think that might actually help there. But also, as you say, the fact that Upolu is so tight and so bulletproof, at least for now, that should, on one level, dissuade you from wanting to join them because, all right, well, I'm just going to pencil myself in for seventh and there's no way to move up. But Coach actually makes that a core part of his pitch to Cochran. It's that we are unbending, unyielding, we're going to vote six strong and you can join us or, I guess, lie down in front of the bulldozer here. And after 18 days in which Cochran has been like jerked back and forth and always been on the edge of his seat expecting to go and then just being saved at the last moment, and he's never found any kind of sure footing, I think just that level of certainty is such an appealing thing for him in joining up with the group where, yeah, at some point I'm going to have to confront the fact that there's a strict hierarchy here, but for now, at least I can take solace in that certainty and enjoy it for what it is.
Right, and I think it is vital that he understands right away, okay, the prospect of flipping someone away from Upolu is essentially off the table. And so the choices are really join with Upolu, and at least in that situation, there is some chance that I'm going to have room to play down the line. Obviously, we know that is not going to work out his way ultimately there. But in his mind, if he's deciding between opening the door for something to happen with Upolu and the other two options are staying Savai'i strong, which is an endgame I already don't want to be playing, and that would require sticking my hand into a bag of rocks to go to bat for what? Ozzy and Keith? It does become a lot more understandable. And there will be other factors that we will get into that probably tip that math a little bit. And in this case, I mean literal math as far as how that hypothetical rock draw would play out. And there probably is more to be said about the mere prospect of, if they are just lying to me and they're just going to string me along and get me to vote with them here and then vote me out in seventh, he probably should have placed a little more weight on that timeline than it seems like he ever ultimately did until that day actually came where he was voted out in seventh place here. It, again, though, does become far more understandable to me than it ever was back in the year 2011, that of course he would be very inclined to want to believe what Upolu is selling.
Yeah, let's we're going to move on to this discussion now between Cochran and Dawn, but I think it's worth rolling an extended clip here for a few reasons. The first is that it's a very clippable season. Like, people give good confessionals. Cochran in particular, flawless diction, by the way. On the Cowboy Rick to Cochran diction scale, I am much more of the Rick to scale. I'm much more of a Rick than I am a Cochran, and I'm very self-conscious about that as a podcaster.
What are you talking about? You and John Cochran are the same person when speaking aloud.
Anyway, Cochran, great confessionals, and it's kind of hard to summarize them because he goes on at length and also kind of works a lot of detail in there. But also, this relationship between Cochran and Dawn and this conversation stands out so much more in the light of just everything that happens in Survivor Karamoan, where Cochran here ends up being the one comforting Dawn, even though he's the one who has the whole crushing burden of this season upon him at this point. And also because this this scene uses that music, which is like the go-to anytime any TV editor wants you to feel sad about something. And it works on me every single time. It just triggers some like Pavlovian thing in my brain. And I don't know what the music's called, if it even has a name or what it is, but it is the most like maudlin emotional thing. And it's the perfect backdrop for this entire scene and really helps to set the tone for the rest of this episode. So let's listen to all of this.
I just want to draw rocks.
Okay. I don't have to have loyalty to the tribe. Because I do feel like there's been a ton of disrespect, and I feel like if I flash back the last 21 days, it's been you and me on the outs.
And Jim Cochran and I went to get tree mail this morning, and I know for probably a good 20 days that Cochran and I have been out here. I've watched Cochran specifically be really treated not as an equal in the group.
That's what I've been thinking about a lot recently.
Oh, I hate this. Go ahead. I just don't want to cry back with the tree mail.
It's totally all right. What are you worried about?
I feel like we agreed to stay with everybody on the drive, and I just feel like you meet these people, and they're like a lot nicer.
Don't worry.
Just frustrating.
Don't worry.
As a Survivor fan, when I watch the game, I love to see people just stand up for what they believe in, kind of at the expense of the $1 million. I mean, I feel like I should have stood up for Cochran sooner. Sorry. He's a really great kid, and he reminds me a lot of... I have a son that reminds me of him who has red hair. But you're trying to kind of protect your interests the whole way through. You want to stay.
I mean, what I've been thinking is, up until this point, my entire fate in the game has been handed over to other people. I mean, I've been groveling and begging not to be voted out since the first tribal council. Now, what we're expected to do is to completely give up our games to fate with the whole rock drawing thing. This is the first moment when I think you too, can finally decide what course you're going to take.
Okay.
And I've always tried to remember it's a game for $1 million, you know, and that this is a game with casualties. But I don't really want the casualty to be Cochran.
Yes, it's frightening how alliances swing. It's more than paranoid aggravation. You're cold and tired and losing sleep. Only the necklace gives a safe sensation.
You're on a mission.
Okay.
Game on.
And this, in some ways, for me, is a way to say, I don't like the way it's been going. Even if it means, you know, I lose my footing in the game.
And to me, the choice quote in a really deep scene there is one which definitely, I will say, stands out to me more now at 28 than it did at 18. But when Dawn says, to me, you're appealing to your emotion. And Cochran says, I'm an emotional guy. And there is so much loaded up in that scene, I think, because firstly, it's an interesting preview as to how Dawn would get herself in so much trouble in Caramon, where there she had this kind of existential crisis almost as she was trying to compartmentalize the game in exactly that way, where you would think Dawn, as the older mother who really just has this pure love for everyone, she would be the one struggling with emotion, and she does. Like, she's frequently crying and so on, and yet when it comes down to it, she can be incredibly mercenary and also like put that to one side and focus on the game. But she's still learning to do that at this stage and with varying degrees of success. And this, I think, stands out to her from her first season as that missed opportunity. Is if she was just able to either put a harder sell on Cochran here or to draw back and to meet him at a more emotional level, then maybe this disaster could have been averted. But either way, she has to pick a side. And the fact that she doesn't do that is what dooms her here. And I think that really informs the way she plays the game in Caramon. But also Cochran saying, I'm an emotional guy. Because certainly with the background that we had at this point, and there was this undercurrent in the online Survivor fan base, which I think kind of crested when we get to like Spencer and Caramon in Cagayan, for example, of like, the way to play as a super fan is I am supremely logical and all of the emotion and the estrogen is over there, and all you have to do is try and reduce it to some kind of equation to be solved, and that's how you you approach the game. And Cochrane has, I think, the self-awareness to know that he can't do that, and also the foresight to know that you can't actually do that. There is a deeper element here that's informing all of that, and you hear it in the way he frames this. I just want to be in control for the first time this game, right? I think that is weighing on him so much more than just the odds, which he doesn't do, apparently, of, you know, this many people are immune and so on, and there's a 2 in 7 chance of this vote working out. And if the others had realized this about him, I think Coach does, and that's what makes the pitch so effective. But if, like, the Jims of the world or the Aussies and so on had realized this sooner, then maybe one of them would be a millionaire today instead.
I definitely see what you're saying, although I really don't know. Just hearing Cochrane talk about this in the moment, if we are just taking it for granted that there's not much they can do about how he feels about the first 18 days he spent with Savai, I don't know that there was anything.
Yeah, I think on like day 4 would be the time, right, to stop.
Exactly. Yeah. But at this point, I don't know that there's virtually anything Don or anyone could have said to get Cochrane to draw rocks. And I think the Savai experience is about as extreme of a case as he's ever going to find himself in, as far as, like, do I or do I not want to draw rocks for these people? But I certainly remember hearing him talk to us and say many times over the years that, like, I'm just not going to risk my entire game on drawing a rock. I don't want this to come down to fate. I love Survivor. I don't love random chance dictating my entire destiny within the game. And I have no idea where Cochrane lands on that these days. And I think he was always pretty happy to grant that, like, mathematically speaking, you would always draw the rock. Like, that's always the thing that you, like, air quotes, should do in this exact situation. But I really don't know that there was anything even Don could have said to him during this conversation that would have changed his mind.
Yeah, I think that's true. And so maybe the line here is to make sure that Cochrane is not someone who is going to be drawing a rock. Maybe if you're Aussie, you transfer the idol yet again back to Cochrane, or you play it on him, or either way, you make sure that Cochrane himself is safe. And so it's not just a sign of trust that once again, I'm giving this to you. It's, we want you to be safe. And so you can put that worry out of your mind. And hey, maybe Cochrane would have had the balls to flip anyway, if he really decided on that. But I think that
he said that himself when we talked to him. If I may take this opportunity to showcase my weird memory. Yes, he said something to the effect of, if I had it to do over again, what I should have done is insist that they play an idol on me. And I think that that probably would have locked in his vote with Savai. And I don't know that they would have loved him coming in and, like, demanding that he be the one who gets guaranteed safety there. But I do think they ultimately would have done it if it meant that he was definitely going to vote with them. And I think he would have voted with them if they had promised to play the idol on him.
Yeah, there's also that possibility, which I think Cochrane actually alludes to with Sophie, kind of in reverse, of the one outcome might be is if he just doesn't tell them that Whitney is going to be given the idol, and he lets that group make the kind of like exactly wrong level move of voting for Whitney, and then Ozzy, to his credit actually, like, and Jim identifying that is probably what they would do. And if he lets the idol be used successfully, he then gets to stay with Savai without having to actually let down the expectations of the Upolu. Like, that would kind of be the perfect thing if he had this bird's eye view of everything that was going on.
And they confirmed that they were going to vote for Whitney until he told them.
Yeah, so as it is, you know, maybe that could have happened. But yeah, I wonder if that insistence that he doesn't want to draw rocks, and he's there to play Survivor, not to play a game of chance, how much of that do you think is an artifact of the time? Because in the years since then, we see the rock drawer as the one thing that people remember mainly about Blood versus Water. And then when we get to Millennials versus Gen X, we have this cast full of heart on their sleeve super duper fans almost being excited and eager to draw rocks. And you imagine if that happened again today, like the Evies of the world on the season would be like, hell yeah, let's go. I'm so glad to be a part of this experience. I don't know temperamentally, just anxiety wise, I guess, if Cochran could be one of those people, like summoning up that same enthusiasm. But I wonder if now, if anything, drawing a rock is seen as part of that survivor experience. And I get to be a part of this, this event that goes down in survivor history.
I think it has definitely gone from once being pretty much the most terrifying prospect that you could lay in front of someone, and that's why it was such an effective means of preventing double ties from happening for so long. I don't know how much Cochran in this case specifically had to do with this, but I would probably guess a pretty significant amount. I think most super fans of the show are not dying to draw rocks. They don't think it's so cool that they want to like check it off their bucket list or whatever. But I think this Cochran and South Pacific situation illustrates the larger point here, which again, I am not taking as hard of a stance on in the year 2021, or at least am far more understanding of why he would not want to do it than I was back when this was happening in real time. But I think Cochran in South Pacific really hammered home for people who were like real students of the game. Sometimes on Survivor, there are just going to be times where the downside of not drawing a rock, if push comes to shove, is just way too severe. And if you don't go to rocks, you are essentially just forfeiting the game. And now, again, I don't think anyone is going out of their way to draw rocks just for the sake of drawing rocks, but I would guess that the average Survivor superfan who is being cast on the show is going into that kind of hypothetical situation from much more of a, if I have to draw a rock, then I have to draw a rock, and that's how it goes sometimes, perspective, rather than this is something that must be avoided at all costs.
Yeah, and when we get to the challenge, it turns out that there aren't just one, but two immunity necklaces up for grabs, and so the odds here could shift pretty dramatically depending on if two people from the same tribe get it, or if it's split 1v1, or whatever ends up happening. And it turns out that Ozzy wins the male necklace, really no surprise there. And then Dawn wins the women's necklace. And so two members of Savai are going to be immune. And crucially, one of those people is Ozzy, who is the one who now has his idol back. And I wonder if that frees him up to maybe make some more creative plays where, just based on his own, like, you know, I have come back to seek redemption and I'm going to use this idol to save my tribe. Maybe he plays it on Whitney regardless. But and that logic that they laid out of they're going to want the more athletic guys to be in the mix for the rock draw, as opposed to someone like Whitney, who they can pick off at their leisure later on. That logic would still apply to Ozzy more so than anyone else. Right. So maybe it plays out the same. But to me, that makes it even more egregious that maybe he has to consider the idea of just give Cochran the idol, play the idol on Cochran, you know, make this statement that I'm willing to really make this sacrifice and lock it in for the sake of this entire group. And when you yourself are immune, it's much easier to talk yourself into that.
Right. And I think it's kind of a double-edged sword here in a weird way, where if I'm coming around on being a lot more charitable towards the Cochran real-time perspective here in the year 2021, I also want to make an effort to do that with the other people in Savai as well. And this immunity challenge falling the way that it did, where two people now from Savai are automatically out of the rock draw. Obviously, the people who get votes on them are going to be out of the rock draw, and whoever Ozzy plays that idol on is going to be out of the rock draw. For my money, is literally the case that if you are one of the Savai'i people, you could not possibly draw this up any better. In the event that we go to rocks, there is now going to be a 5 out of 7 chance, roughly like a 72% chance, that Upolu draws the bad rock. And when I, random Savai'i member, pair that information with what appears to me to be a fairly straightforward Upolu dynamic of, obviously, we cannot knowingly or willingly let these 6 people take the majority within this game. That is completely off the table. You cannot voluntarily do that. The fact that the situation from like Jim's perspective, for instance, is so straightforward from every conceivable angle, I think may have kind of compelled them to be a bit rougher with Kaga. I'm struggling to find the right word, but I think from their perspective, it was such a no-brainer that of course Cochran can't flip. We could not ask for a better situation here.
And yeah, and that's what perversely makes it more self-defeating, right? Is that because the logic to all of the non-Cochran people is so obvious and they're correct. I mean, there's zero chance in the world that any of the other 5 end up flipping, I would wager, then because it's so obvious to them, surely it should be obvious to Cochran too. Right. And the fact that he is wavering in public, it's like, well, let's just put the boot in him even further to try and, you know, knock some sense into him. And so from Cochran's side, it's, well, yeah, clearly they're so just not thinking about the position I'm in here. And this is yet another example of that. So, yeah, it really just digs their grave even deeper. But yeah, well, once you look at the numbers, you almost have to like process of elimination away a bunch of these people, where so Ozzy and Dawn, they're out of contention. And then so that brings it down to 4. You know they're not going to vote for Cochran because he is the one person they need to flip over to their side if any of this is going to avoid a tie. So it's going to be for one of the other 3 people. And so in this actual universe where they don't give the idol to Cochran, the odds are pretty good if they take that 1 in 3 shot, assuming there is no double agent stuff going on, that they just win the vote outright there and then. And maybe, okay, they use the idol on Whitney, and then maybe the Upolu idol does actually get produced, and then they have to use it, and maybe they get their 1 in. And it's actually harder for them at that point, right? Because maybe they get their 1 in 6 shot right. But even if after all of that, you know, they use it on Whitney, but someone else gets votes. Well, okay, Whitney, Dawn, and Ozzy are all out of the mix. The person who gets voted for is immune on the revote. And so it's essentially just 2 Savai'i people, including Cochran, up against the remaining 5 Upolu people. And those are fantastic odds, as you calculated here. Over 70% that Savai'i ends up on the good end. So even if you know, you take every other factor out and you just look at the raw arithmetic of it, like Savai'i should be winning this vote so much of the time.
Right. Although again, Cochran is saying repeatedly in this episode, I'm not here to do the odds, I'm here to play Survivor, and he says somewhere along the way, I don't care if it's only a 1 in 30 chance that I draw the bad rock, I'm not going to rocks. And it's something, when we interviewed him, even having seen how the whole season played out multiple times, he said it was just off the table for me, the idea of going to rocks. And that is something I think is just kind of a fundamental misunderstanding, maybe the wrong word, but like a pretty sizable leak in Cochran's game there. I again have come around a lot on understanding why for this particular group of people he would not be inclined to stick his hand into a bag, not feeling good about a potential kind of Savai'i end game if this rock draw does end up going well. But at the same time, if you stick with Savai'i and the rock draw does go your way and you prevent Upolu from just freezing everyone else out for the rest of the game, I think one thing that I can't imagine he wasn't considering out there on the island, but for my money, wasn't considering strongly enough, because just kind of by definition, if he were considering this prospect and placing enough weight on it compared to the others, I feel like he would recognize in the grand scheme of things that, like, you don't have to go down to an all Savai'i endgame, even though the Upolu people are probably going to be mad at you for such a big time bait and switch, where you get their hopes up that you are going to flip over with them. I still believe that particularly like Sophie and Albert would have been very willing, if they were suddenly finding themselves down in the numbers, to make a move later with Jim and Dawn, alongside Yu Cochran. And you don't have to be in the end game with Keith and Whitney and Ozzy, and there is going to be plenty more room to play there. So while I have come a long way compared to where I was in 2011, as far as at least trying to see more of this from the Cochran perspective and sympathize with the decision that he ended up making, and it does feel a lot more justifiable to me just watching this back for the first time in quite a while. Unfortunately, I still have a hard time kind of changing my conclusion about the general idea that, like, you just have to go to Rocks here when the alternative is opening the door for Upolu to freeze you out, even knowing that Coach and Sophie and Albert are stringing him along.
So, big picture, you're there to win, and I assume that's your only goal here. How do you win if you're fifth on Savai'i and you now have a majority Savai'i jury, and you, I mean, they were not disposed towards you to begin pleasantly to begin with. Now they hate your guts. And, okay, I don't think Dawn hates your guts. I think you could maybe, you might actually be likely to get her vote, if anything, depending on if the move that you make here actually plays out for you by taking you to the end. But then, Keith and Whitney, never getting their votes. Jim, I think Jim would say that he's voting on who played the best game and so on, but I don't think he could ever bring himself to respect that move in the first place, and so even if he is sincere about that, that would disqualify you for him in all likelihood. So that's three votes down the drain. Ozzy, I could actually see coming around to, like, maybe voting for Cochran if he has some story of transformation, whatever, but I don't really want to be taking your chances with that. So you're at least three votes down, probably closer to four votes down, and you have to beat the two people that you're there with who, you know, looking at it from the outside, you would say, all right, well, Rick, we never see anything of Rick. He's not playing the game. He must be a goat. Or Brandon Hans, how could a Hans ever win Survivor? He must be a goat. In reality, as Sophie told us, Brandon and Rick were perhaps two of the biggest jury threats out there. It still blows my mind to this day. Brandon Hans was going to win Survivor. He gave away $1 million when he gave away that necklace, probably. So with all of that in mind, like, who is Cochran even meant to be beating once he gets down to that end game? Like, is it Albert and Edna, maybe? Like, if Coach doesn't own his game, maybe it's Coach. Or lest we forget, people, I mean, Savai'i didn't like Sophie. They thought she was the best of a bad bunch, at least in that final vote. So, but they hate your guts even more. So you are the worst of the bunch at that point. So just big picture, the moment you flip, I think you are officially drawing dead. I don't know how you ever finagle your way, even if you can get to the final three, which is a tall order in a tribe as fixed as that one. How do you actually win? Like, what is this playing towards?
So I don't have some mapped out solution in mind, but the counterpoint I would make to that is, the moment you don't flip, it is literally game over. You are 0%. If you flip, it is game over, is what I'm saying. Upolu, you have lost on the spot 100% of the time. Whereas, I don't know what the dream combination would be, and I will readily acknowledge that Keith and Whitney are never voting for you, certainly people on Upolu probably aren't going to be thrilled with you, and others on Savai'i may end up not being at Final Tribal Council very open-minded about how things went. But sight unseen, about just making this decision on night 21 or whatever it is at this point in the game, the 0% chance, the hard 0% chance that you have of winning if you allow Upolu to take the majority is at least worse than the, in its most pessimistic timelines, 1 or 2%, and I would say the number is higher than that, that down the line, some way or another, you are able to kind of flip the game around and make some sort of cross-tribal alliance, bring in Sophie and Albert and Dawn and Jim or whatever, Rick, Edna, who cares? There is at least a case that can be made for you being the central reason that the game played out the way that it did, and that, and obviously I would say Cochran is kind of the central reason for the game playing out the way that it did, not going in his favor this time around, but you're at least not a hard 0% the way that you are if you allow Upolu to take a 6-5 majority.
Yeah, I think in the most abstract terms possible, here is the terrible choice that you're faced with. You have a tribe of people who hate you and a tribe of people who like you. Who do you want to work with and move forward with? The sad answer that you're committed to is the tribe of people who hate you, because what needs to be true mathematically for you to win is for two of those people who otherwise would be voting against you to be your opponents in the finals, so that you actually free up a possible, you know, jury majority to bring over to your side. And I think that could happen. I think if Cochran, you know, you imagine Savai'i takes control, Keith and Whitney are just adulterizing or whatever over in the shelter, not socializing with the rest of the group for the next 15 days, not endearing themselves to the group, not playing the game. All right, I'm going to take Keith and Whitney to the end, and I'm going to win $1 million, probably, with, you know, people like Coach and Albert and Sophie making the case for me from the jury bench. Or I imagine you don't want to go with Dawn, and I know that when the earliest spoilers for Caramone came out, people thought, well, there must be a mistake here. Like, how is Cochran, of all people, beating the universally beloved mom who's, like, sending bread to people from across the country? But, you know, he found a way. That Survivor's fun like that sometimes. I imagine you don't want to go with Dawn, but maybe. And who knows how Ozzy is actually being received? Like, would they respect his challenge abilities, or would they vote against him because he's just kind of an asshole? And then there's Jim, who I don't know how he fits into that equation, but either way, you have options, and you need two of those people who will never be votes for you off the board in order for any of that to be possible.
I have a hard time coming up with ways the game plays out where Cochran is able to get to the end with Keith and Whitney, because it seems like it would probably require Keith and Whitney also wanting to go to the end with Cochran, and I don't know just how likely that is, but I do think it's at least more likely than Upolu giving the game back away. And that is just, I'm very eager to acknowledge that the number of winning timelines for Cochran are probably not high. And back in 2011, I feel like the kind of prevailing timeline that I had in mind was you play down to like a mostly Savai'i end game, at which point you can just kind of identify, obviously we need to get rid of Ozzy. We can't let him touch the end game here, where you can just run the table and provide for everyone and take home the win. And then Keith and Whitney are such an obvious pair that I don't think it would be too difficult to get Jim and Dawn on board as kind of this end game majority, and I'll sit in the finals with them and, to be honest, probably lose, but at least have a shot there. And then furthermore, there are also other possibilities of going to the end with a Sophie or an Albert or an Edna. Many different combinations of people. I feel like without any kind of concrete plan is not worse than completely ending your game the night of the merge. And to his credit, one quote that I did want to flag up that I am now desperately scrolling around on my notes to find is when he's giving his confessional about, like, finally I have control in this game. And he says something like, and furthermore, I might have complete control over not only how this vote goes tonight, but how the entire game plays out. So I do think it is at least worth acknowledging that Cochran clearly recognized, if I do this, there is at least some chance that Upolu just runs the table on us, we get pegonged, and I've given the game away. I don't think it's, like, lost on him that that is well within the realm of possibility.
And this is why I set this up as a tragic choice, because I do think that you're 0% to win once you flip at the merge here, or basically it's a rounding error. I think that you're still pretty damn unlikely to win if you stick with Savai, but the question becomes, like, if you think that's also close to 0%, then yeah, why not go with a group who actually treats you like a human being, gives you the time of day that you want to work with, and if it can't be you who wins, and it sounds like it surely can't be, then at least one of these people is going to win instead, versus, you know, the Savai group who, that no one's going to feel good about that. I can see yourself, if you really think that you're out of commission because that message has been beaten into you for the past 18 days, then why not try and become the kingmaker? And it makes a lot of sense kind of through in that vein. The same reason why I was more sympathetic to Ben Driebergen falling on his sword at the end of Winners of War, because, hey, if you're going to tell the guy that he can't possibly win, then what do you expect him to do at that point? However, if you think that there's, like, even a tiny glimmer of hope, like a 2% chance that you could win the game, I think that chance only exists if you stick with Savai here. And that's the rub. That's what makes it so difficult.
Right. And from Cochran's perspective, I think he was probably thinking about it in roughly those kinds of terms of, this is going to be a tremendously uphill battle whichever way I end up going here. And obviously we are able to sit here, you and I, Dom, with the benefit of knowing Upolu is never going to turn on each other. And I think the other people in Savai who were not interacting with the Upolu people were pretty clear on the idea that Upolu was never going to turn on each other. But Cochran specifically was getting the full song and dance from Coach and Sophie and Albert about how much room he was going to have to come to play if he comes and flips with them that night. And so if he's sitting there thinking, whichever side I end up going with here, I am in a very precarious position almost every single time, no matter what, it again becomes a lot more understandable why he would go with the people that, one, seem to like and respect him versus those who have spent the last several weeks making it clear that that is largely not the case for them. And two, and I think this is a much bigger factor in it for him than who do I like more, is if I go with Upolu, I have a very small chance. If I go with Savai, I have a very small chance. But going with Upolu does not mean sticking my hand in a bag. And that is the thing that I want to avoid more than all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's so much going into that vote. And this entire episode, there's no wasted time other than, you know, normally the Redemption Island duel and everything around that kind of cuts into the meat of the episode. Here it was essential for setting up this eventual storyline. And this episode, it really feels like it's barreling towards this inevitable conclusion. And you know that from the outset. And the entire episode is in service of building that up and then priming you for this reaction when that finally happens. And I love that. As much as I enjoy these merge episodes where you really don't know until the votes are read where it's going to go and where the game's going to go from there, this time I think you did, but also you were kind of like, you were able to just sit back and enjoy that and kind of let it happen from there. So we are going to read the votes, and the first vote is for Keth, because Brandon Hans cannot spell Keith properly, corrects that on the revote. So reads the room, or I guess maybe just reads the vote instead and corrects that. But that was a nice way to kick off that whole episode there. And so it turns out that, you know, Cochran has passed that information about where the idol's going to be played. So that clever idea, which would have worked out to put it on Whitney, falls through. Keith is going to be the victim here. And then on the revote, Jeff times the reveal perfectly, where he's about to do what he's done so many times and turn over the vote to announce a tie. And then he says, you know, 8th person voted out of Survivor South Pacific is Keith. Not the first member of the jury, because Keith is going to be going straight to Redemption Island, where he will be unceremoniously booted off in short order by Ozzy, who is soon to join him there. But this, I remember in real time, like, obviously, this was the episode that primed us to start podcasting about it, because it was so interesting, because it was such a great episode. You're not going to do it just in the middle of the season, apropos of nothing, after a forgettable episode 5 or whatever, right? But this episode, like, there was so much to talk about, and then also the episode itself as a TV product is just so phenomenal from start to finish here.
Absolutely. An episode that holds up extremely well. And yeah, actually, one random thing, but you just reminded me of it. As far as Jeff and the timing on that last vote, he really nails it, where normally, if the vote is that close, he'll open the last parchment, read it himself, say 8th person voted out of Survivor, and then slowly flip it around. But in this case, the big reveal is the fact that this parchment means we now have the 8th person voted out of Survivor. So he opens it, reads it to himself, doesn't say anything, and then as he's flipping it, says 8th person voted out of Survivor. Really pro stuff there from Jeff. Really probst stuff there. All right. Awful. Terry shouldn't have said that. But
that is the ruling is in. That is not anything.
Not anything. It's nothing. Yes. But yeah, a fantastic end to an all-time merge episode for my money here. And yeah, of course, an episode that will forever hold a place in my heart as the one that kind of began this whole project for us in the first place. But Dom, one
we,
other...
We should not gloss over Brandon Hans's role as the burly protector of yes. Morgan here, where as the verse revealed, Jim twice, it seems like, unless it's some weird editing Frankenbiting going on, just calls Cochran a coward. And on the second time, Brandon says, don't talk to him like that. That's what you get for talking to him like that in the first place. Just with this very like righteous anger. And he's like patting Cochran on the back and bringing him in so that he's physically protected as well. It's just so, everyone plays their part here to perfection. It's so good.
It's very, very strong stuff there. And for the record, and I'm not sure how many times I've ever really said this before in the 10-year history of the podcast, but Brandon Hans is dead right about this, that like the reason Cochran ended up flipping is because of the way Savai treated him for the duration. I think there are many other timelines where if particularly like Jim and Ozzy, I don't think Keith and Whitney had much of a chance at making Cochran feel much better. Like that's just way too far outside the realm of possibility for me. And maybe even Ozzy is a stretch here. And again, big time Jim fan in general, but probably a lot more could have been done over those first 18 days that may have prevented Cochran from making this decision.
This is why I think Jim is still the best of his archetype after so many years, and why I was so sad not to see him on Second Chances, is that he is wolfy and he is so expressive and so like kind of maniacal at times, and he will call you a coward to your face, and he will like get angry and then go back to like scheming with this shit-eating grin, and he's so dynamic in a way that, you know, a lot of the game bots, if you want to dismiss him that way, through the years have not been. Like, he is an amazing character on top of being a fun player and a good player, I think. For the most part, and part of that is he does have this flaw where he can't rein it in sometimes, and I think it is in Jim's range, but he just can't bring himself to actually do it, and that's his tragic downfall. But Brandon, I think it should not go overlooked how it's not just that Upolu core that makes Cochrane feel at home. It's all of the others too, where we have this brief montage of like Cochrane is talking to Rick in the water, and he's with Edna, and Brandon is acting like Cochrane's his like little brother, even though it's hard to find two people more different than Cochrane and Brandon, right? If it was just this like ruthless business-like core of Upolu treating Cochrane well, then it might be easier to think, okay, well, yeah, they're doing it because it's business for them and they're putting on a front because they need to win this vote. But the fact that it's also the outsiders who don't seem to be playing the game in any discernible way, it's the Brandons and the Ricks and the Ednas, they also make Cochrane feel totally at home as well. And so like it's this whole picture being painted that you want to see for what it is.
I remember Cochrane saying in that interview that he gave a confessional that he was shocked didn't end up making air because it was such a good potential piece of like foreshadowing for the way this was going to play out, where at some point near the end of his time at the Savai'i beach, he said, I feel like on Savai'i, I stick out like a sore thumb, and then I look over at Upolu, and it's a tribe full of sore thumbs. And I think he probably entered the merge predisposed to feeling much better about the Upolu kind of vibe than he did about the people he'd been with to that point. And furthermore, I've said many times over the years, and this is probably at least slightly hyperbolic, if not extremely so, but like, I really think you would have a hard time drawing up a worse starting tribe for Cochrane 1.0, like on his first season, than the one that he actually got. And obviously variance regresses to the mean, and on his second season, he ended up with one of the best starting spots in the history of Survivor, but particularly as a first-time player, I think this was just about as rough as you could draw it up for Cochrane. And I think under other circumstances, his initial appearance on the show probably would not have been such a frantic mess.
Yeah. And it is a fun hypothetical of you take some random other first timer on Upolu and swap them with Cochrane. How much better or worse does that person fare? But also, what does Cochrane do instead when he's officially under coach's wing from day one, or, you know, future close friend in real life, Sophie Clark, you know, they get to team up together and do some damage, or, you know, Albert and Cochrane, again, incredibly different people, but they share that love of the game and that need to think about it in a certain way that I think they could do some good work together. And then, you know, maybe Cochrane and Brandon would get along well. So, yeah, I think Cochrane 1.0, if you put him on Upolu, that might be kind of quite far in the other direction of all the starting tribes you can imagine. This might be one of the best.
Totally, yeah. And there is at least one silver lining, and I deeply reject the idea that I have certainly heard many people float over the years that, like, this should be weighted into his decision-making in the process, but, excuse me, his decision-making, like, thought process in the moment, but when you do flip at this merge vote, you are putting yourself in a pretty solid position to potentially make a big name for yourself and be invited back for a future season. So, like, I am not even remotely down with the idea that, oh, Cochrane flipping was actually the right move because it meant he got to come back for Karamoan, where he obviously went on to steamroll that season. Like, that's crazy. He does not know that Karamoan is going to be a thing when he's actually in the position where he's making this choice. But as we will see actually play out here, it is going to make him, at least in the short term there, an icon of Survivor as a franchise, and I think he still is one of the most memorable people of the last at least decade or so. And while I don't think it was like wildly shocking to see that he ended up declining Winners at War, it really seemed like he was both potentially trying to distance himself from Survivor and also feeling like he probably didn't have a ton to gain by going back for another season where he was probably pretty unlikely to win and wanted to stick with whatever he was doing in his real life at that point in time. It certainly is worth acknowledging that the decision to flip here, I can't imagine what Cochran's kind of like place in the pantheon of Survivor history would look like had he made the other choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Incidentally, Dom, if Cochran had come back for Winners at War, and obviously this is a very difficult question to answer, but like, do you think he would have been considered one of the new school people, or is Cochran already old school?
No, I think he has to be new school, because you had that run on that season of like Kim, Denise, Tyson, and Cochran being the one gap in the middle there. Tony, Natalie, and then I guess Jeremy. There's a small gap again before 31. But yeah, Cochran fits squarely in the middle there, and the one person towards the start of that is Boston Rob, who I guess in those terms is middle school-ish, but yeah, he's old school and he knows it.
Okay, and then some other returnees that we did end up getting to see. Obviously, Cochran comes back and crushes Kara Moen alongside Dawn and Brandon. We've talked about both of them in passing. A lot more, I think, would be interesting if we were to look at South Pacific in a bit more detail about specifically that Cochran and Dawn relationship this time around and how it plays into the way Kara Moen ultimately plays out there. Although that might then also require rewatching Kara Moen to really understand the full context of, and I'm not super interested in that, in that being a thing there. We do see Ozzy come back again for Game Changers. Dom, Survivor trivia question. Tell me one thing that happened to Ozzy in Game Changers, because I do not remember any of it.
I remember on
the boat.
He's on a green tribe. Yes. Green team.
No clue.
Green buff.
No idea.
Okay. Okay.
I remember on the boat on day one, when there's some sort of challenge where it's like, all right, one person from each tribe is going to swim out and go get something that's floating in the water out there some distance away. Ozzy like rips his shirt off and dives in, and no one from the other tribe even bothers like competing against him for it. And that is pretty much all I remember of Ozzy in Game Changers.
Yeah, there's really not much to remember as far as I can tell. And I'm no Ozzy fan really, but it's sad that his legacy had to, that is the most recent thing that it ends on, where each of his prior seasons, you know, Cook Islands, a beloved fan favorite, one of the, you know, the most exemplary physical player that we'd ever really seen on the show up until that point. Micronesia, you know, massive character. His blind side is what lets the Black Widow Brigade really take control, and then Showman to the Manda. So much stuff going on. Big character that season. South Pacific, right here, right now, you know, you can't tell the story of the season in so many ways without Ozzy. It wouldn't be the same, and I think it would be much worse without him. And then Game Changers, he's just kind of there along with everyone else.
Yeah. I don't think Ozzy is alone in that distinction on Game Changers. We also see Sophie, of course, back for Winners at War. That was a ton of fun. Loved seeing a modern look at Sophie, the Survivor player. I thought she totally delivered, and I was heartbroken when she went out at the point where she did. You know, solid enough run for sure, but I think certainly was in the mix to bring even more to that season if things could have broken her way near the mid game there. And I'm sorry if I am forgetting other people from this season that we've ultimately seen back. I guess Keith and Whitney went on The Amazing Race, but one other thing that I saw recently on Twitter is friend of the podcast Coach Wade celebrating his birthday, and I believe using some sort of hashtag about like bring back the Dragon Slayer or something dumb. I know Jeff has said that like people from the first 40 seasons are probably not going to be returning anytime soon. And even if they were, I don't know where Coach would be on that list at this point, having played as many times as he already has. But if there were some sort of eventual like all-time legend season, which may be unlikely as things stand now, having already done Winners at War and so many other returnee seasons along the way here, I still am holding out some sort of hope. And I think I would be here for it at this point, now that so much time has passed since we have seen Coach. I think I'm ready. Not necessarily right now, but ready to be open to the possibility of Coach returning to Survivor, which it seems like he wants to do. Where are you on that?
I don't think it's ever happening. We are in this phase where they are kind of memory holding everything that happened in the past. We're dropping the four and keeping the one, apparently. And even if those first 40 seasons are still in play, keep in mind, this is Coach's most recent season, and it's season 23. And we are converging on the point of that being like the halfway point in the entire show's run. So Coach, most definitely old school. And I just don't know if the modern fan nowadays has a vivid enough memory of Coach to be, you know, I don't know if the man on the street is knocking at Jeff's door, clamoring for that to happen.
So I don't know that, like, the median Survivor fan, now that it has become explicitly like a family show where we want a bunch of little kids to be watching who were in many cases born long after Coach being on Survivor was even a thing. But as far as people who have been watching every season along the way and only tune in on Wednesday nights and never think about the episodes again, I think you would be hard pressed to find many others who have stayed in the casual fan's memory to the same degree that Coach has. There is no doubt in my mind, if I were to text casual Anna right now at 2:45 in the morning and not get a response, if I were to ask her, she 100% knows who Coach is.
Yeah, if Coach does come back, he will have to keep it PG-13. No stories of Amazonian tribes eating his ass or anything with all the kids at home.
I mean, the kids are into that.
Watching attentively.
Right. Okay.
Okay. Anyway, it did remind me, though, of in that big speech where Coach, once again, lest we forget, physically draws a line in the sand. One of the most jarring, like, standout quotes from that is when he's talking about how he understands what it's like to be misunderstood, and because he's so clearly a superior being, for people to find other ways in which he's inferior. He says, "I might be the Dragon Slayer now." And it's not like that's a title that you've earned or been given. You just call yourself the Dragon Slayer. So either you are or you aren't, you know?
Well, he might be. He's not saying he is. He's saying he might be. So, yeah, a couple other random things before we close up here, Dom. Turns out I had no memory of what Whitney Duncan's face looked like. I certainly knew she was that, like, she was blonde and good looking. But I guess in my mind, whenever I thought of Whitney Duncan, which was not too often, I somehow replaced her with Natalie White. I thought she looked way more like Natalie White than it turns out she actually looks like. There is no way I would have recognized a picture of Whitney if I were not prompted with, like, this is a person from specifically Survivor 23. And incidentally, I believe it's the case that Keith and Whitney are still married, right? Do we know?
Yeah, I believe so. One of the more long-running, not just Survivor couples, but reality TV couples. So, you know, good for them in that sense.
And when is the last time you think that they just, among the two of themselves, talked about Survivor, other than people asking, like, how did you meet? Do you think they ever talk about Survivor?
Absolutely not. Would be shocked if they have watched an episode of the show, other than, I guess, maybe, like, if they're showing a friend or family member, like, a clip of them, or maybe not, I don't know. But yeah, they come back for The Amazing Race, and this is even before the era of, like, Big Brother casting, for example, where the first question when you walk in the room is, are you single, are you ready to be in a showmance on national TV? Even before that was just, like, the main reason that those shows existed, the fact that they were in a showmance was enough to, like, propel them into, you know, another 15 minutes of fame there.
Right. We, in our most recent podcast, talked about some chart that had recently come to light. Incidentally, found out that is via the statistics tracked by @Rob's Fact Checker. So I'm taking them as gospel, that this is actually airtight science here. Both of them, I believe, very near the top of the all-time list of, like, most invisible Survivor contestants in history. And even they were brought back for another shot at CBS reality just because they love the storyline of, like, Survivor changing people's lives, and credit to them. Like, clearly this has worked out for Keith and Whitney. So good to see that. I believe that's going to do it for the Survivor South Pacific merge recap 10-year anniversary. Want to once again reiterate, South Pacific, I don't think, is a season that is very near the top of a lot of people's lists of like all-time favorite seasons, but as far as I've ever been concerned, one that is historically kind of underrated. There is a lot of kind of formulaic stuff when you think through just the general sequence of events, and I understand why people are not dying to rewatch it necessarily, but having spent plenty of time now away from having seen episodes of Survivor South Pacific, watching it for the first time in pretty close to a decade, if not literally a decade, I was not exactly like blown away, but I was very pleasantly surprised by just how well this held up on a rewatch. And I don't know that the entire season necessarily would be of this same caliber as this obviously very exciting merge vote, but certainly one that whenever the time comes that I decide, all right, I'm going to do a big Survivor rewatch of all these seasons I haven't seen in a long time, I'm getting more and more excited about the prospect of South Pacific.
And hey, if you out there, whether that's the patrons or just the listeners at large, if you decide that's something that you want for us or from us, then hey, we could have that conversation too, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is Survivor 41, to date this podcast, because that's airing right now, has been so good that I've been very happy to focus most of my Survivor attention there. But I could certainly see a South Pacific rewatch and re-podcast coming down the line at some point. Dom, anything else you want to get out there?
I'm good. I mean, it's so we could reflect, I suppose, on just where the podcast has come in the 10 years since then. I hope that the audio quality of this episode is a little better than our first offering back then, and just the overall production quality, rapport, every aspect of it. Hopefully we have learned something in the 10 years doing this. But yeah, this was a very fun episode to revisit. You can tell, I think, why this was the one that really inspired us to get all of this started back in the day. And yeah, very glad that you came up with the idea for this and we got to mark the anniversary this way.
Yeah, I mean, pretty confident that the audio quality is better and hopefully the rapport is better, considering, again, the first time that we talked through this episode 10 years ago was literally the first face-to-face, so to speak, conversation that you and I had ever had. I knew that you were British, but I had no idea what your accent sounded like, and boy was I blown away, and still am not sick of it there. But yeah, Dom, 10 full years, it truly crazy to me that thinking back on like the first time we sat down to do this, beyond inconceivable that we would still be here. I didn't know if we were even necessarily going to do a second episode, let alone a second season or second year or anything.
Yeah, you hear all of those stats about there's this just graveyard of podcasts on iTunes or any podcast aggregator where it's like so many of them. I think they say if you get past 10 episodes or 15, like somewhere in there, that's the hump that you have to get past. And maybe then if you're still in a regular rhythm, then you have what it takes for the long term. But so many, they put out one episode, they ride high off the momentum of that for a bit, they do a few more, and then they just abruptly peter out and you never hear anything from them ever again. Honestly, kind of expected that to be the fate here, but still going strong after 10 years. And, you know, our engagement with Survivor has ebbed and flowed and changed over that time, but still in here and always willing to talk about something.
Yeah, a sincere thank you to you for being willing and able to tolerate me for this long. I would have taken way the under. And I think if you had gone back to 2011 and told us individually, like, oh, this is going to be a thing that goes on to be like a defining part of your adult life, I would have been like, oh, wow, cool. And Dom probably would have been like, absolutely not. Get me out of here. I can't do 10 years of this guy. But one way or another, in very British fashion. I feel you have been able to grin and bear it and stay with me. So that is very much appreciated there, and very much appreciate you, the audience, who have been able to stay with us for this long, however long you've been listening as well. And of course, long may it continue. Dom is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. We will see you guys 10 years from now when we return for another look at the Survivor South Pacific merge. But until then, talking season 41 on the main feed these days, about to wrap up on the Mole 2 over on the Patreon feed at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. Dominic, anything else for the people today?
I'm good.
All right. I am good as well. Great times. We will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.